don't know if it works, but I like the idea of it. Oh, I forgot to put a little hash stopper.
A hash stopper? I singed my hair.
No, this little meteor jumped off the end and landed on your finger, but it didn't seem to bother you.
Oh. Okay. Hello.
Welcome back. Or welcome.
Welcome back. Episode 2. Last time we talked about Sumerians. And we touched on our subject for today. The group that is essentially responsible for separating the Sumerians from the Neo-Sumerians is the Akkadians. They came in and fucked shit up for like 200 years.
Is that the Sumerian Dark Ages?
No. I wouldn't call it that.
But it was the time between Old Sumerians and New Sumerians?
Yeah. No, there was always Sumerians. It was just the time between the Sumerians being in power and then the Sumerians being in power again.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's like right around 2334 is when the Akkadian Empire got started. It came from an interesting character. It was actually the first person in history to have an origin story that we all recognize, where he was born illegitimately. His mother was highborn and had a child out of marriage with a lowborn, and she didn't want anybody to know. So when the baby was born, she put him in a basket, and floated him down the river, and eventually wound up on the shores of Kish, a city called Kish, and was taken in. Well, depending on which story you listen to, either he was taken in by the gardener and trained as the gardener for the palace, or he was taken in by one of the governors, one of the main governors for the king of Kish at the time, Urzababa, and then given a job in the gardens. Either way, though, story is that he was a gardener in the palace for the king of Kish.
But he was a highborn bastard that was given up, basically.
That's the story that he made up, yeah.
That he made up.
Well, yeah, none of it's real. I see. Yeah, this is all just...
It's allegorical.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, it's all just made up bullshit afterwards to...
Give somebody a story.
Give him a story.
An impressive story.
Cool.
Yeah.
But either way, he wound up like right around the middle of the 2300s BC... wound up as like the head advisor for the king of Kish, whose name was Urzababa. Still Urzababa.
Also.
Urzababa was still rolling. which is kind of interesting because he didn't sound like a very good ruler, particularly. The story goes when Sumerian named Lugalzagesi. I think we talked about him last time.
I was going to say that name rings a bell.
Yeah, we talked about him last time. When he showed up at the gates of Kish, Urzababa was like, okay, you win.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that was that guy.
Well, he just wanted to keep the peace, so that's why he stayed forever. He just like, you can do whatever you want, just let me keep my spot.
Yeah, nobody was really fucking with him. till Lugal's Augessi came around. Yeah, Lugal's Augessi came in. Depending on who, again, depending on which story you pay attention to. Well, as the story goes, Urza Baba was already starting to have questions about... we haven't even said his name yet. That's kind of funny. Dun-da-da-da! So, the guy that we're talking about, the whole origin of the Akkadian Empire, the man who was floated down a river by his mom.
Allegorically.
His name was Sargon.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, now we're on track. We started with the story and then we got sidetracked.
Got sidetracked by the story into another story. So anyways, so Sargon, hanging out as the cupbearer, being the main advisor for Urza Baba. Urza Baba starts to get a little nervous, being like, I don't know if I trust this guy after a while. And there's a couple stories that say he even tried to have him killed. Urza Baba tried to have Sargon killed a couple times and didn't really work out. Some stories say that he tried to negotiate with Lugal's Augessi to try to get him to kill Sargon. And then, again, depending on which story you listen to, either that just didn't happen, or Lugal's Augessi just, like, ignored it, or Sargon joined up with Lugal's Augessi and then went and took Kish.
Yeah, let's do this.
But really, I think what I saw mostly... was that when Lugal's Augessi came to Kish, Sargon actually went and took troops to take Uruk, which was another city that Lugal's Augessi had taken. He took Kish, and then Sargon took Uruk, and then Lugal's Augessi got a message, was like, yo, this dude just took your city. He said, how dare you? And... he went out to take it back, and Sargon whooped his ass.
Like, battle style, like, with their armies?
Yeah. And then...
who was Sargon's army, then? The city he overtook?
Urza Baba's.
Gotcha.
Yeah, he like, siphoned off troops from Urza Baba. Probably was, like, building up a movement over the years, like, getting himself support in the military. Like, I call it a military.
So where did
wasn't
he
really
a
military.
Come from if he didn't get floated down the river by a hootamami?
Well, I would have told you that if I knew.
And so no one knows where he actually came from. Maybe he was just the gardener's son. He just didn't, you know.
Yeah, but it'd be interesting for the gardener's son to wind up as the cupbearer of the king.
Not that weird. All you have to do is be charming and be in the right place at the right time.
What do you mean not that weird? Compared to what? Compared to all, like, the ancient history that about?
No, I just mean compared to, like, you know. If, say, it was in modern days, like, somebody who lives in the White House is probably way... That's not a good analogy. He was close. He was close enough to be familiarized with
right? Yeah,
royal
there you go.
People.
So the evidence,
you
yeah.
can, like, wiggle so, your way in yeah. and eventually rise up.
So, yeah, if you want to, like, try to, like, reverse engineer the story almost and, like, try to pick up clues, you're right. It is probably likely that he was... at the very least, somebody close to, close to the palace, like. But yeah, no, they have no idea. That's the only story. Sir Henry Rawlinson was an archaeologist who, in the 1800s, went and found the ruins of one of the most famous libraries from the ancient world. The Assyrian king Ashurbanipal, who ruled in the 7th century BC, had this really impressive library, but eventually, I believe it was the Medes and the Babylonians.
Babylon.
I think the Medes and the Babylonians came in and wrecked his shit, and basically just, like, destroyed the whole city, but basically preserved it so that, yeah, it's,
the library?
Yeah, so this archaeologist, Sir Henry Rawlinson, was able to find it in the 1800s, and that's where he found the story of Sargon.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So back to Sargon. His actual story.
Actually, yeah, and I'll tell you, I have it pulled up right here. Here is actually a real excerpt from the legend of Sargon. So this is actually the...
Is that a book?
This is the... well, it's a cuneiform tablet.
Okay, so this was part of that
like
library.
Several cuneiform tablets, yeah.
Gotcha.
So it says, this is of Sargon's path, of Sargon's origin. My mother was a changeling. My father I knew not. The brother of my father loved the hills. My home was in the highlands, where the herbs grow. My mother conceived me in secret. She gave birth to me in concealment. She set me in a basket of rushes. She sealed the lid with tar. She cast me into the river, but it did not rise over me. The water carried me to Aki, the drawer of water. He lifted me out as he dipped his jar into the river. He took me as his son. He raised me. He made me his gardener. So yeah, it's very much just like a made-up origin story, just to kind of establish.
The drawer of water. So his dad was the drawer of water, and he made him his gardener. That's what he says.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically the interpretation that says, like, yeah, this is the one that says, like, the gardener of the palace is the one who found him and made him.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's very much just a story created later on to give himself a past. So yeah, he basically took over and like he beat down Lugal Zalgesi, which like we were talking about last time, Lugal Zalgesi had already established like a decent setup, like a little proto empire essentially in Mesopotamia.
Right.
So it was really easy for Sargon to go in and be like, all right, yeah, this is mine now. But then on top of that, he went in and took like a bunch more places real quick. Basically just like one of the most advanced, it was the most advanced military. Like what you would call a military for that time. It was the most advanced that the world had ever seen.
Sargon's?
Yeah, and he just went and just wrecked everybody's shit all up and down. Just took everything. Like, took it as under his control, I mean. And, yeah, and went up to really give himself a new setup. He went up a little bit further up the Euphrates, I believe. A little bit north and west of where the main central Sumerian area had been, and he established a new capital called Agad, which, like A-G-A-D-E, which gets translated as Akkad, which is why they call it the Akkadian Empire. A lot of the reason we call what we call the people from the ancient world is because of Hebrew translations from the Bible.
That makes sense.
But they're translated from Sumerian and like Sumerian and Akkadian and Assyrian cuneiform tablets, and then just translated into Hebrew, and then we translate them in English. Like Sargon's original name, I believe, was like Sharrumkin, and then it was translated into Hebrew as Sharkan or Sharken, and then now in English we call him Sargon.
Sargon's mask.
But we do know, okay, so here's the thing. We do know that he was likely, we know he was Akkadian, you know. We know that he wasn't we know that he wasn't Sumerian. And so the Akkadians were actually a people before, well, I should say, there's evidence to say, to suggest that the Akkadians were a people before Sargon. There are some tablets that were found in the ruins of a really wealthy city called Mari, I believe, that they found that actually predates Sargon, that shows some Akkadian writings. And that's another thing. So Akkadian is like a Semitic language. So like the Akkadian people were just... that like the Akkadian, being Akkadian just meant that you spoke the Semitic language, like that form of the Semitic language, that particular branch of a Semitic language.
Like a dialect?
I don't know if it would so much be a dialect. That'd be an interesting question, actually. I would be curious to talk to like a linguist. Yeah, or like a language, I guess. Yeah, a linguist or... there's somebody who specifically studies like ancient languages, like what like how that is actually all really determined. Because it's one of those things. It's like, yeah, the Acadians. So the Acadians were people that came in from like the south and the west.
But they just weren't called the Acadians until they lived in this city named after a god.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But they're already like. But there's evidence that their language kind of existed before that.
Gotcha.
So it is like, possible that Sargon actually was. So that's the thing. So some historians have suggested that Sargon was actually like re-upping the Akkadian Empire, like re-establishing the Akkadian Empire, and not just establishing the Akkadian Empire. And not necessarily like before it was clearly not an empire, but just as far as like the people, like some people suggest that like the Akkadians were, you know, more established than is currently recognized or thought. So yeah, we do know that he was an Akkadian, and yeah, when he came in, he basically came in, and instead of what a lot of like the Sumerians before him had done, when they would go on little, you know, proto-empire building runs, they would go in and they would just say, all right, like, this is under my control. But, like, you know, they would mostly leave the people in place and they wouldn't really mess with stuff.
That's the smart way to do it.
And, well, you know, it's a way to do it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Depends on the situation. Fair. But mostly that's how it had gone. It would be, you know, they would come in and they would be like, all right, this is under my control now. You're just going to pay me the taxes and you keep doing your stuff. And yeah, like, you could, there's arguments to be made to say that that works to a degree in certain places. But Sargon came in and just had a different idea and basically said, no, like, I'm putting in my governors, I'm putting in the people in these places. Like, they're going to be my people. They're going to be Akkadians. Like, even, like, you know, he would take over the Sumerian city-states and he would put in Akkadian governors and Akkadian, you know, like priests and things. And actually, but that's the thing, like, and, but he also, it wasn't as if he was going in there and disrespecting these cities. Like, he would absolutely respect, like, he respected the gods, and like respected the gods of each city and, paid tribute to them. And, you know, and like we talked about last time, like, that's what mattered. If somebody came in and was like, I'm taking out all of your administrators, here's my offering to your god, and they're awesome. The people were like, yeah, this guy's cool.
Right, like, if things don't get worse for them.
Yeah, usually. And so he actually even made his daughter as the moon goddess.
It's a bold move.
In one of the, I'm trying to remember which city it was. Hold on, now I have to know, because it's going to bother me. Moon god of Ur, installing his daughter. Oh yeah, that's what it is. So he installed his daughter as the high priestess of the moon god of Ur. And Ur was, yeah, one of the main cities. So yeah, he paid his respects where he needed to, but he just put his own people in. He just put his own people in there just to make sure. And that's the thing. And it worked. Like, he established a very strong empire. And, you know, part of that has to do with the fact that he established one of the first professional standing armies, if not the first professional standing army in history. He was like one of the first. It's argued, you know, a lot of these things go down. I'm getting really close to the microphone. I'm sorry. A lot of these things, you know, when they talk about what came first, it's basically like, all right, we're pretty sure it happened in Mesopotamia. But there's also evidence that it may have happened in the Indus Valley in India or in the Yellow River Valley in China. Like, writing. Like, there's, you know, because it all comes down to the dating. And the dating isn't precise, you know, when you're going back 6,000 plus years. So there's arguments, you know, there's evidence to be made for different areas having the first. You know what's really weird to me?
What's that?
The Western world identifies so strongly with Mesopotamian, like, early ancient Mesopotamian societies.
Do they?
Like, yeah, they just, like, I feel like, I feel like there's a strong Western bias towards wanting the Mesopotamian cultures to be the first, rather than the Indus Valley or the Yellow River civilizations to be the first when it comes to things like writing or sailboats or whatever it might be. I feel like there's a strong Western bias towards Mesopotamia, which I do find interesting because, you know, they're not, it's not Western, like, it's the Near East, like, it's, they're called, like, that's what they call it, it's ancient Near Eastern studies, but still, I think it's just, I think, I don't know, I think it's just interesting. I don't actually even want to go further than that. All I want to say is I found that, I found in my reading that I've tended to notice, and especially like, you know, in our, you know, especially in our culture, you see it. Like, you've heard more about the ancient Egyptians than you have about the ancient Chinese or the ancient Indians. Like, the Indus Valley civilizations and the Yellow River civilizations were, you know, some of the most important and advanced civilizations, and they predated the Egyptians. And, you know, we have like, you know, maybe that's what it is. Actually, now that I'm talking about it, maybe it's because there's so much archaeological evidence that's been discovered for those civilizations as far as, you know, actual physical proof of their existence. That's just buried in the sand rather than maybe in those other places. A lot of that stuff existed, but has just been built up. But it's just been built up over time, and just evolved over time, but not necessarily, like, I feel like with the Mesopotamia, you know, now that I'm saying that, yeah. Like, with Mesopotamia, you saw that region kind of, you know, it was the Fertile Crescent, and then it went through some climate shift, and it changed, right. And peoples moved out of there so that, you know, there are these ancient ruins in the middle of these deserts, whereas in the Indus Valley and the Yellow Valley, like, today, there are thriving civilizations going on there, so there's a lot less archaeological evidence to be found to kind of build up the picture of those civilizations. Hmm. So maybe that's more what it is. That kind of makes sense. I don't know. I'd be curious, because maybe when I go looking more into those civilizations for the Human History Podcast, well, maybe my perception will change. But yeah, maybe that's just me projecting my Western historical background. But it is, like, going back to school, you learn about the ancient Egyptians, and I've always known that the ancient Sumerians were, like, you always just hear about them as, like, the first people, like, the first civilization. I don't know, it's interesting. Anyways, going back to the Akkadians. I digress.
That's what it's all about.
So, Sargon comes in. Basically establishes this really strong empire, and it's not just military. Like, as far as the records can tell, he was a really good administrator and really just a really effective leader overall. He introduced, actually, it's interesting, he introduced, like, standardized weights and measures so that trading could be done you know, more honestly and effectively and efficiently.
Nice. I'll trade you 2 stone for.
Right? Yeah, I would be curious to actually, like, go into more details on that. It didn't really. But, you know, he pumped up building, like, the action on building roads and improving, like, the irrigation systems. He was a big fan of supporting the arts and culture. And so his daughter that I mentioned earlier,
the moon priestess,
the high priestess for the moon god of Ur, she's actually the earliest named author in history, in human history. Oh, yeah? Should I call you at Heduana, or should I call you the High Priestess of the Moon God of Ur?
The second one.
There we go. I can dig that.
Okay, what were you saying?
Just be like, at the restaurant, be like, walking away for a second, but then forget, and then just turn around and be like, hey, High Priestess of the Moon God of Ur?
No, not the whole thing.
Come on.
Only in formal situations.
Oh, I see. What are formal situations? When we do, like, moon ceremonies?
Yes.
All right. But so she's actually the earliest named author in human history.
Nice. That's a fucking Jeopardy question.
Uh-huh. Sargon's daughter and Heduana. She was a poet.
Nice.
And, yeah, we have...
That was a long time ago.
I think her works, again... If I'm not mistaken, this part I'm not 100% sure on. I think her works were found in Ashurbanipal's library and dated. That could be wrong, though. But yeah, I do know that she is like the earliest named author in human history.
Nice.
So yeah, that's pretty cool. So yeah, that would have been right around... So 2334 is when he established the Akkadian Empire. So that, yeah, when she was writing poetry, that would have been... recorded and kept, that would have been right around, like, you know, the 2320s, 2310s BC. So we're looking at, 4,300 years ago.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Uh-huh.
So he ran a good empire, not just because he had an iron fist, but he did well in general.
Yeah, I mean, he made everybody's lives better. He essentially did exactly what he was supposed to do. He gave everybody more access. Like, he expanded, not by expanding his empire, like, that expands trade routes. But then he also expanded trade routes out beyond the empire. And, you know, depending on which sources you look at, will tell you how far his trade route went. And, you know, the archaeological record is interesting on that, too, because it can kind of tell you, oh, like, there was this type of stone that we know came from an ancient mining region that was in this part of India. So they know that they had to at least have had trading that far.
Right.
but, yeah, I mean, he set up a good empire. And he ruled for, like, 55 years, I think, about. And
that's not bad for those days. Lived to be that old.
Again, I say 55 years. That's coming from, I believe, the Sumerian Kings List, which, again, you know, take it not necessarily with a grain of salt, but, you know, there's something to be said for a lot of ancient history being unclear and easily. But again, like a lot of, like, we do have corroboration on what is this, like, the earliest Sumerian king that we have corroboration on their rule was right around like 2800 BC, I want to say. Enmerkar, I believe, was the king's name. So, you know, I guess, you know, maybe it's a little more accurate than I'm giving it credit for. I just tend to take everything in ancient history and be like, they say 55 years. To me, that means anywhere between, like, 10 and 55. No, not really. Because it all has to, like, come together with the... So, you know, yeah, right around 55 years. So, yeah, good long time. Did well. His son, Ramush, came in. Expanded the empire a little bit. Did, like, just basically maintained it. Well, like, when he first came in, there was, like, big rebellion, which happens every single time there's any type of, it's straight up like Game of Thrones style, like,
power
exchange. Anytime a king dies, it's like, sweet, time for rebellions and, like, plots and shit. So just kind of like par for the course. So his son Ramush comes in, puts down, like, a 5-city rebellion. It's like, sweet, I got this. Like, expands the territory a little bit. Only rules for, like, a few years. I want to say it was, like, 7 or 8 years, maybe. And then he gets killed by his servants.
Oh.
Yeah, it was, like, a palace assassination plot. And
shouldn't have been a dick.
It's one of those things they're like, don't really know the origins, but what that meant was his brother Manishtushu was now king. And so if you think Manishtushu may have had something to do with it, I don't think that's necessarily out of line. But it's never really like suggested or said. It's just like, we don't really know what happened. His servants killed him, and then his brother was king. And you're like, okay, well, I can guess what happened. And then his brother basically ruled for like 14 years. Didn't really do much. Kind of seems like he took credit for some of the stuff his brother did. But the reason that he is important, Manishtushu is important, is because he is the father of Naram Sin, who was the greatest of all of the Akkadian kings. And honestly, the Akkadian Empire was the greatest empire of ancient Mesopotamia, likely. So that makes him probably the greatest empire, the greatest king in ancient Mesopotamian history.
What was his name?
Naram Sin.
Naram Sin.
Yeah. So his whole thing, like, he was essentially Sargon again, but even more.
Wait, where did he come from? Sorry.
He is Sargon's grandson.
Gotcha.
So Sargon's son Ramush came to the throne.
Right.
He got assassinated.
Yeah.
Then his brother, Sargon's other son, became king.
And then this was his son.
And then this is his son.
Okay.
And yeah, Naram Sin was essentially, he essentially had all the features of Sargon and then some. You know, they talk about him expanding the empire through really effective military campaigns. But not only that, the fact that he was out there leading on the front lines, like, he was leading the military campaigns, like, as a warrior and just crushing it. And again, I know I don't have to keep saying this, but there's this thing in my brain that, like, every 2 minutes or so just wants me to say out loud, "So the story goes." But let me just say that. I'm just going to say that now. I'm just going to say this once for the rest of the time. "So the story goes." So I don't have to say it. Just keep that in mind. So yeah, he was just this badass warrior who was out on the front lines, crushing it. Expanding the empire, but then also doing all the same things, you know, to keep the empire going from within, as far as supporting the arts, making sure that all the gods were pleased, and keep infrastructure, keep building infrastructure, roads, irrigation. So essentially this goes on for another good long while. And actually, I do want to talk about one of the things about Naram Sin, there's many reasons he's remembered. But one of the things that kind of differentiated him and kind of changed the scene a little bit as far as kings were perceived in the ancient world. It's like, for the first time, so like we talked about, kings always paid respect to the gods, right? And they were always like, "I'm here because the gods are cool with it. And like, if I'm doing well, it's because the gods are like, they're cool with me." Naram Sin was the first one to kind of come in and be like, "Nah, I am a god." But here's the thing. He didn't say, like, "I am God." And he didn't say, "I am the god." He didn't say, "I am God of gods." He just said, like, he recognized himself as a god. He declared himself a god. And it's one of the most famous ancient artifacts is the Victory Stele of Naram Sin.
The victory what?
So it's called a stele.
Stella.
Stella.
Stella. Stele?
S-T-E-L-E.
Stele.
I always want to say steely. Like, some people say steely. Yeah, some people say steely. I've heard, like, steely or Stella or steely. No, now you've made me forget what I even called it. What did I call it?
Stella.
I didn't call it a Stella. You call it a Stella, and now I can't remember what I called
Stella.
It. A Steely.
It is almost Stella.
It's a Victory Steely.
Stella.
No, it's Stella. A Steely. It's a Steely. Now I remember. I'm not that high. I'm pretty high. But, all right. Yeah, it's called a Steely. So it's basically, it's this clay tablet that basically has this representation of an event on it. In this case, it was a tablet representing his victory over mountain tribe, some king.
The mountain tribes.
It was always the mountain tribes, honestly. The Lulubi, the Lulubi or Lulubi people, they're a mountain tribe people to the east. And he basically went in there and defeated them and their king in battle. But if you look at this, the Steely, it's different because a lot of times before that point, you would see these representations kind of in tiers where it would show at the bottom, it would show kind of the soldiers in the muck of the fight. And then in the middle tier, it would kind of show like the kings or like the, the higher echelon people, and then it would show the gods in a higher echelon, just the scene in that kind of that representation. But this one was more like it was situated vertically, where it was basically this figure of Nar, which you know is Naram Sin, and he's just basically going up this mountain, and it just represents him just like moving up this mountain and dominating. And you could see like the soldiers and stuff below him, like he's just on top of them, like moving up this mountain, and he's on top of the mountain, but he's like twice as big as everybody else in the representation. And he's got this helmet on that, it honestly reminds me of, I guess it's kind of stereotypical, but it reminds me of Vikings. Like it's like that helmet. It's got a helmet, but it's got the two curved horns on the side. And yeah, he's just got this big curved horn helmet on, which I think I read was like that was generally reserved for deities, like that sort of adornment.
Right.
And yeah, he shows himself in it, and then yeah, you see later on like he starts to sign his name, or like when you see his name on tablets and stuff, it's accompanied by the mark that is essentially reserved for deities as well. He was essentially the first king to start doing that.
Gotcha. So he's not like, it wasn't just a power position anymore. I was like, I'm anointed.
Yeah, he's like, I am not here because of the gods' favor. I am a god.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, no, so it is. Never mind. It's not just.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, but again, just like, I am just putting himself into the pantheon more so than putting himself above, like, on top
mere
of it.
Mere mortal.
Right,
with
yeah.
With approval. Interesting.
So, yeah, but again, like, he was still very effective, and he still did, as far as the records can tell, like, he was a good leader, and he did well. And by good, again, I don't mean like good as in like morally good or bad as far as our standards. I mean good as far as like, yeah, he was very effective. He maintained control and relative peace over his empire for a really long time, and expanded it, and expanded the road system, and expanded the trade system, and expanded and improved irrigation methods, and all these things. And one of the interesting things is, for a really long time, for centuries, for millennia, for thousands of years, even after that, not sure exactly like when it would have begun, but for some time into close to what we would call, I guess, year zero. At least up until the time of Ashurbanipal's library. That's the thing. So in Ashurbanipal, King Ashurbanipal. He's the Assyrian king. Yeah, I'm excited to do the Assyrians. That's it. Yeah. And the Assyrians apparently had some pretty impressive empires. Well, the Assyrians were one empire. Oh, no. I think it was similar to the Sumerians, where there's an Assyrian empire and there's like a Neo-Assyrian empire. But anyways, I'm excited to get to them. But at least to the time of his library, which would have been, you know, the 7th century, so around 600, around 600 to 700 BC. So, you know, like 1500 years almost, like about 1500 years. People essentially associated Naram Sin with pride in a negative way, and like defying the gods. And basically they had this whole idea that, and they actually blame, like, they had this idea that he was the reason for the fall of the Akkadian Empire. Like, so I'm rambling at this point. There was a story in Ashurbanipal's library called The Curse of a God.
Mm-hmm.
And what it essentially was an amalgamation of all of the different rulers of
the
an amalgamation, like
I don't know what that is.
Just like a mix, just a mixture of a compilation of all the different kings and their deeds and the things that they did during their time as the ruler of the Akkadian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Basically took different stories, mixed them all together, put Naram Sin under like the umbrella of it all, and proceeded to tell this story in which this man, who is Naram Sin, has his city's favor taken away by the chief god Enlil. And as such, no other gods were able to bestow their favor on his city. So essentially they were fucked. And this man, who's Naram Sin, had no idea why it happened. There was no explanation. So he basically, proceeded to, go and ask the gods. He basically, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? He petitioned them for an answer as to why his city had been treated so.
Mm-hmm.
And he never got an answer for years. And he waited, it says he waited 7 years and never got an answer. And one day just lost his shit and took his army, essentially, and went in and raided the temple at Nippur, which is the sacred city, which was Enlil's city.
Oh, that's dangerous.
So it went in and destroyed the sacred temple of Enlil in the city of Nippur. And because of this, the gods got really upset, especially Enlil, and basically just set in famine and brought in, rebellion and
locusts.
And so basically there ended up being an invasion from a nomadic people called the Gutians.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically Enlil sent the Gutians in famine to take out the Akkadian Empire because Naram Sin and his buddies defamed
the gods.
But none of that is true. Well, it may be true that the temple was destroyed, but it wasn't Naram Sin. And the famine, the Gutian invasion, and the famine that took out the Akkadian Empire, which is what took out the Akkadian Empire, was an invasion from the nomadic people combined with famine that kind of swept through because the climate was changing.
Yeah,
like we were talking about last time, like it just had that effect of like, it's a domino effect of you can't pay your soldiers to, maintain the edges of the border, because you can't feed your soldiers because there's no food and you're not making taxes off of the land who's supposed to be selling the food. And it all basically adds up to being very, you know, open to invasion. And yeah, the Utians basically come in and fuck shit up, and the famine makes it very hard for the Acadians to fight back. And that's essentially what happens, like, after. So Naram-Sin, again, rules for, like, I want to say it was, like, 35, 36 years. Nice long reign. And then when his son comes in, that's when it all starts to kind of, like, you kind of start to see it. Oh, you know what? Maybe it was, like, his son, and then, Yeah, his son's name was Sharkali Shari, and he was the one who you can kind of start to see the edges start to fall apart. You know, they had the same thing happen. You know, Naram-Sin dies, and now there's going to be rebellion and things like that. But Sharkali Shari just could not handle it. Apparently, or just did not do a very good job at handling it.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of led, you know, it just kind of starts to crumble from there. And, you know, it was about, I think it was two kings later, there was two more kings, and, you know, the Gutians came in. And honestly, it's one of those things, it's one of the bigger mysteries of the ancient world. Is at the end, we know that, like, those last two kings, they pretty much just had control of a god. That was pretty much their purview.
The city.
Yeah, just the city. But really, in the end, we don't really know what happened to the city. The city, we have no idea where it was. We still have no idea. It would just basically got... It apparently it got so destroyed that it's just erased from all record, apparently, but they are still looking for it. Because yeah, that's the thing, we don't really know. We know that the Akkadian Empire essentially ended sometime shortly after Sharkali Shari's reign, like effectively ended like sometime in or shortly after Sharkali Shari's reign, who was the son of Naram-Sin.
Right.
And but we don't really know what fully happened after that. We just know that the Gutians came in, took control of a bunch of places. Not necessarily control, because they were a nomadic people. They just, like, messed stuff up. Like, really just made it so that they couldn't, you know, nobody could establish any power. Like, it was just a lot of chaos. But then the famine was there as well. Which made it very difficult. And yeah, there was, I think, and that was right around, I want to say it was like right around 2100, like right around 2100 is when they estimate, like, the real end came. You know, that was, and then it took another, and then, you know, we talked about last time how a little bit of time went by, and then you saw the Neo-Sumerian Renaissance take hold. And, yeah, that's the story of the Akkadians.
So what's Sargon's mask from our game?
Oh, Sargon's mask.
That's, we have a board game. It's a museum game, and it's like all these different artifacts and stuff. And one of them is Sargon's mask.
Sargon's mask is... It's funny, because they actually... I wouldn't even say that they're 100% sure that is Sargon. They think that is Sargon. But it is... it's a representation of him from... they think shortly after his reign. And it's just, I think it was, I can't remember exactly where they found it, but they found it in ruins, in ancient Mesopotamia. Oh, you know what? I think it was actually taken off by the Elamites, who I'll be doing an episode on the Human History Podcast soon. I believe at some point they came in and took a bunch of artifacts from Mesopotamia, Akkadian and Sumerian. And I think the Mask of Sargon was one of the things they took, and they may have found that mask at Susa or one of the other Elamite places. I don't know. I'll check in on that. We'll update you on that one next time. But yeah, it's just, it's nothing. It's more of just like a remnant. Like there was probably several of them, and that one lived, so to say. That one made it through time and was preserved.
Gotcha.
But yeah, that mask, I think, yeah, that mask is still like 4,000, at least 4,000 or 4,100 years old. And it is very cool. If you get the chance, just Google Mask of Sargon. It kind of shows you the style of, because it seems like a very realistic representation of, as far as a stone carving can go, as far as what their style would have been like, as far as their headdress and hairstyle. But yeah, it's very cool. It's very striking.
Neat.
Yeah. So that is the Akkadians. And that is our second episode of 420 BC. Thank you. I like it. Oh, what are we doing? Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I thought we were doing some patty cake thing.
Kind of, sort of.
All right, well, I only know one patty cake thing. That wasn't a sexual
reference. I was going to say, because that sounded like a sex joke.
It wasn't a sex show. I do know one patty cake. What is the one? Never mind. We'll talk about it later. Anyways, thank you guys. And if you enjoy the show, please don't hesitate to throw us a rating and tell your stoner friends or anybody who just likes laughing at stoners rambles or listening to history. Thanks again. And I was going to say we'll see you next. I always want to say like we'll see you next time. We won't. So I'm just going to end with
how I always end.
Be excellent to each other.